Welcome to Human Rights 2020s, a podcast from the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. This episode is a recording from an event titled Our International Human Rights, The Right to a Healthy Environment, held on the 13th of June 2024. In this episode, Senior Policy Officer Lucy Miller introduces Benji Brown from the Environmental Rights Centre for Scotland to discuss the right to a healthy environment and the impact it could have when it is incorporated into Scots law. We hope that you enjoy this episode.
Hello everyone, we're just going to get started on this lunchtime's Human Rights Bill webinar series, and today I'm delighted to introduce Benji Brown from the Environmental Rights Centre for Scotland, and we're going to be talking about the right to a healthy environment today. So Benji, do you want to give yourself a better introduction than I've just given you there?
Thanks, Lucy, and hi, everyone. It's great to be here today. I'm Benji. I'm the Policy and Advocacy Officer at the Environmental Rights Centre for Scotland, or ERCS for short. And our vision is of a Scotland where everyone's right to a healthy environment is respected, protected and fulfilled. We do this by assisting the public and civil society to understand and exercise their environmental rights. We provide free legal expertise and advice on public interest environmental law so that people can take action to enforce their right to a healthy environment. We undertake awareness raising and outreach with marginalised groups across Scotland, and we also do advocacy and policy and law reform to change the legal system and ensure it works for both people and planet. And my role is focusing on the policy side. So I work with MSPs in the Scottish Parliament to ensure we have the best available laws and regulations to defend and protect our environment. And one of the areas I'm working on is, of course, the proposed Human Rights Bill and incorporation of the right to a healthy environment in Scotland.
Thanks for that, Benji. My name's Lucy. For those of you that don't know me, I'm the Senior Policy Officer here at the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. So just moving on to the first question, Benji, can you please tell me in a nutshell what the right to a healthy environment is all about? Basically explain the essence of the right to a healthy environment and what does this right aim to achieve for individuals and communities in Scotland?
Thanks, Lucy. So across the world, the use of fossil fuels, industrial expansion and our overconsumption of resources are causing injustices for people and pushing the planet to breaking point. This should come as news to no one. With climate breakdown, biodiversity loss, and the widespread pollution of our air, land, and water, we're now facing a triple planetary emergency. So taking on these environmental challenges has never been more urgent. And Scotland is not immune from these problems and these cascading threats. We must urgently tackle our own environmental problems and their unfair impact on marginalised groups. Pollution, proximity to contaminated land, and poor access to nature-rich green space are all examples of substantive environmental problems. And they contribute to inequalities across Scotland in terms of people's health and well-being. Children, older people, disabled people, and people with pre-existing health problems are often the hardest hit. We also have procedural problems in how we can use the law to protect and enforce our environmental rights. So we should be able to effectively hold public bodies and polluters to account in a court of law. But as things stand, it's incredibly difficult to use our legal system to do so. It's complicated, intimidating, and expensive. We need urgent change. We need an enforceable right to a healthy environment in Scotland so that we can tackle these substantive and procedural problems. This will enable us to stand up for our health and for the planet to achieve a fairer, greener and healthier Scotland for everybody.
And why do we need a specific focus on the right to a healthy environment instead of it being included under broader human rights? Given that environmental issues impact everyone, why is there a distinct emphasis on the right to a healthy environment as a separate category? What makes it unique?
That's a great question. A healthy environment underpins and enables the realisation of all other human rights as a precondition, essentially, of the right to life itself. Yet it's taken time for the environment to be given due regard and recognition in international and human rights law. It was only in July 2022 that United Nations General Assembly recognised and declared the access to a clean, healthy and sustainable environment as a universal human right, and acknowledged that environmental damage has negative implications for the effective enjoyment of all human rights for present and future generations. 160 countries now include the right to healthy environment in their constitutions because it's necessary for the effective fulfillment of other rights, including the right to life, health, food, water, culture, and development. But unlike many other rights where cases are often articulated at an individual level, there's important collective dimensions to the right to a healthy environment and interdependencies when it comes to environmental rights violations that require special attention and are not necessarily captured in other rights treaties. So to make a real difference to people's lives and effectively protect the environment, new rights need to be clearly defined, and that needs to happen according to the highest possible standards. So according to scientific bodies such as the World Health Organization when it comes to air quality, or the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change when it comes to reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. And this is necessary to prevent any willful misinterpretation by duty bearers and ensure proper accountability can take place.
And from my understanding, the UK has signed several international agreements recognising the right to a healthy environment already. What obligations does this create for the UK now prior to a Scottish Human Rights Bill? And how is compliance currently monitored? And are there any problems with that? Considering the UK's commitments to international treaties and agreements that recognise the right to a healthy environment, what are those current obligations?
So as I mentioned, the UN General Assembly declared the right to a healthy environment 2 years ago, and this was a key milestone in advancing our substantive environmental rights, and that was supported by many countries, including the UK. Builds on decades of interpretation by binding human rights tribunals and authoritative human rights bodies, as well as evidence compiled by UN special rapporteurs, including the special rapporteur and on human rights and the environment. As it stands, the human right to a healthy environment is only partially recognised in Scots law. So the substantive element of the right, which is due to be incorporated as part of the new Human Rights Bill, is currently not recognised in law at all. And the procedural element of the right, which refers to the right to information on environmental matters, to public participation in environmental decision-making, and to access to justice on environmental matters, that's currently enshrined under the United Nations Aarhus Convention, but it's not been fully implemented by the UK or Scottish governments. So the right to a healthy environment will only really work if it has teeth, if it's effectively fully enforceable as part of the new Human Rights Bill and accompanied by fundamental reforms in terms of access to justice. And as I mentioned, we have these six substantive features which we need to be to have enshrined in law. So that includes clean air, a safe climate, access to safe water and adequate sanitation, access to healthy and sustainably produced food, non-toxic environments in which to live, work and play, and healthy biodiverse ecosystems. And so all of these distinct features need to be recognised within Scots law. And as I said, they need to be recognised and defined according to these high standards with adequate enforcement mechanisms. And that comes back to the procedural element of the right, which is enshrined in the Aarhus Convention. And these procedural processes need to be improved so that access to justice is accessible, affordable, timely and effective for everybody. The UK ratified the Aarhus Convention in 2005, and it places special obligations on the Scottish Government to uphold these procedural elements of the right to a healthy environment. Compliance with the Aarhus Convention, this UN treaty, is monitored by a special committee of legal experts, the Aarhus Convention Compliance Committee. And since 2011, they've repeatedly ruled that the UK is in breach of its legal requirements to uphold procedural rights. Specifically, the the UK, and indeed Scotland, is in breach of Article 9.4 of the Convention, which requires that access to justice is fair, equitable, timely, and not prohibitively expensive. As things stand, our legal system is incredibly unaffordable. And if people want to use the legal system to defend the environment and go to court to challenge public bodies or polluters for not adequately protecting the environment, their legal costs can spiral to thousands or indeed tens of thousands of pounds. So it means that it's incredibly difficult to use a legal right to remedy, and the legal system can be quite easily captured by more powerful and better resourced companies or other groups who may not have a good interest in preventing environmental harm. And going back to the Aarhus Convention, this key treaty that we do have, which enshrines these procedural rights. So the committee in 2022, they required the Scottish Government to produce an action plan detailing how it would meet recommendations to fully uphold access to justice requirements of the Convention. And this required necessary reforms, such as reforms to legal aid to ensure it's easier to undertake public interest and strategic litigation, to ensure the burden doesn't always fall on individuals for taking on environmental cases when often they impact whole communities. Also to reform legal expenses, which currently incredibly unaffordable, as I mentioned, and as well as other matters that required attention, such as time limits for judicial review and many other areas which were in the action plan. So anyway, the Scottish Government did respond and they produced this action plan, but unfortunately, we only have 4 months to go before a crucial deadline to meet the recommendations. So that's the 1st of October, 2024. And the Scottish Government is woefully failing on almost all counts. And we're going to be publishing a new briefing next week, which sets out in great detail just all of these areas where the Scottish Government has really failed to act fast enough. And these are actually really straightforward reforms to enact. It's important to say that. Like, it's been clear for a very long time what needs to happen to change, but we're lacking the political will to really bring these changes into effect and ensure that we have the tools to uphold our right to a healthy environment. So it's really critical that we build pressure on the Scottish Government in the coming months to address these access to justice requirements, which actually do impact across all human rights, not only the right to a healthy environment, and ensure that we get real action. And I know Human Rights Consortium Scotland has produced a great report making human rights justice a reality, which also goes into what needs to change on access to justice in more detail.
Brilliant. Thank you for such a thorough answer. I had subsequent questions coming up in my head, but you then continued to answer them all. So I will move on to the next question, which is telling us a bit about the core components of the right to a healthy environment. So what are the fundamental elements that constitute it, and how do these components interact to ensure comprehensive protection and sustainability? I guess really how, you know, it can be very hard to dilute the jargon of international human rights into what it actually means for communities. I think this would be a good point to give that example. You've went into it briefly in the last answer, but what does this actually mean for change?
Yeah, so I think this comes back to these six distinct features of the substantive element that I mentioned. So just to recap, we have clean air, safe climate, safe water and adequate sanitation, healthy and sustainable foods, non-toxic environments to live, work and play, and healthy and biodiverse ecosystems. And if we just take one of those examples, so for example, air quality and upholding the right to clean air, that would mean enacting policies so that air quality meets the high standards set by the World Health Organization to address particulate matter, to address damaging greenhouse gases such as sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide, which damage both our health and the climate. And we know this has real implications, especially for marginalized groups and people with pre-existing health issues. And obviously, a few years ago, some of you may be aware of the very tragic case of Ella Adukasi Deborah, who died just age 9 from an asthma attack, which was linked in the inquest to poor air quality in London. And that really underscores why this is so important. And so this is a really vivid example of, you know, why a right to a healthy environment is so significant, because without it, it damages both our health as well as, you know, the broader environment in which we all share. And that can really compromise our long-term prospects. And, you know, it has implications for the realization of all of our other human rights as well, and our right to dignity and like living a dignified life, essentially. And yeah, so having these procedural and substantive rights enshrined and being able to exercise them could really transform how the government makes decisions about the environment, tackling some of these root causes of food and fuel insecurity and improving our health and well-being. And I think also would provide a bit of a backstop, you know, when they are under pressure from vested interests. You know, obviously we've seen the kind of very facile debate around the introduction of new policies for clean air and clean air zones recently. And I think having a right to a healthy environment and knowing that there's legal protections and duties on government to uphold that could really transform some of that debate as well, and how governments and local authorities consider their duties to the public. And yeah. I think just another thing as well, with the right to a healthy environment, obviously we often have these policy silos where we talk about the environment on one hand and human rights and kind of social justice on the other, and actually they're fundamentally interlinked. So adopting a human rights lens, I think, can really illuminate how environmental hazards are unevenly distributed and environmental burdens are experienced differently by different social groups. A good example of this is around access to green space. And we've seen how local authority spends have been cut repeatedly during years of austerity in terms of like spending on green space and, you know, public amenities. And often this is left to like the poorest areas being hardest hit. And we see, you know, parks in disrepair, real issues around the environmental quality with litter and just public neglect. And I think that really illustrates the kind of inequality dimension of some of these environmental injustices, which need to be addressed. So having the right would really clarify relationships between rights-holding citizens and duty bearers, by which we mean governments and public bodies, such as CEPA, our environmental regulator, but also companies whose activities might adversely impact that right. We know, obviously, a lot of the examples of pollution and environmental damage come from negligence or companies putting their, you know, the profit motive above care for people and nature. So I think there's really critical elements here which could be addressed through having this right enshrined in law.
Yeah. And are there any particular environmental rights that you think are at risk in Scotland? So in our context, what aspects of the right to a healthy environment do you believe are most vulnerable or at risk? And are there current threats that exacerbate those risks that this law will help address?
Well, yeah, I think in Scotland is an interesting case because obviously we have huge tracts of land which are very sparsely populated in the Highlands and Islands, and, you know, often considered like wilderness areas, even though there are obviously key communities who inhabit those areas, crofting communities and others. But there is this perception that, you know, the Highlands and Islands and mountains of Scotland is a real haven for wildlife and untouched natural landscape and area of natural beauty, which to some extent is true, but also has in fact been really intensively managed. And it's important to note that we are one of the most nature depleted countries in the world. Out of 240 countries and territories, Scotland is 28th from the bottom in what is known as the Biodiversity Intactness Index, which is basically tracked and measured the kind of integrity of like the natural world and how much biodiversity we still have within our country. And while this largely does measure like historical losses of species, we know that biodiversity is continuing to decline and a huge amount of work is needed to get it back on track. So yeah, I think that's one example, and much of this is a consequence of how land is managed, and in the Highlands and Islands in particular, that is partly about looking at land ownership and like large landowners who remain largely untethered from any real obligations to think about communities and ecosystem health. And we see that where, in fact, we have some of the most concentrated land ownership in the world, with half of all privately owned rural land in Scotland owned by just over 400 individuals and companies. And we see how, land is often managed for specific purposes, so like shooting estates or for grouse moors, for example. And I think grouse moors are a really good example where we see, they have a negative impact on climate and air pollution when it comes to the burning of heather moorland. And this also has implications for wildlife in terms of habitat destruction. And then a secondary impact as well, because these areas of land and the grouse moors are for, yeah, the purposes of hunting grouse. So it also has a knock-on impact for wild birds. And we see poisoning, trapping, and shooting of wild birds such as white-tailed eagle, goshawks, and red kites, which is obviously a real tragedy, and has not really been properly addressed. Other examples could include commercial forestry plantations in the Highlands, and we're seeing large tracts of land converted to just fast-growing Sitka spruce at the expense of our native species in ancient woodlands, which obviously matters for nature and biodiversity, but also is really important for people's well-being and health as well. We know that how important some of these areas are for tourism and recreation. So yes, if communities were able to enforce their environmental rights, I think it could change. It could trigger major changes in terms of how and in whose interests land in Scotland is managed.
Brilliant. Okay. So the final question is, if the principles of the right to a healthy environment were more deeply embedded into Scottish law and policy, what specific areas do you think we would see the most significant improvements in, and how would these changes manifest in practice?
Yeah, great question. So I think if it was more embedded in law, one benefit is that it would change the way in which governments and local authorities really think about policy, and hopefully we'd have much more joined up and holistic policy making. So especially when it comes to spending decisions and also other fiscal measures. So tax, for example, is a good area. We know there's lots of changes to the tax system where I think, if environmental considerations were given more thought, we could have like a much more progressive system. And I think overall there would be much more thoughtful design in terms of policies and proposals, ideally with a more long-term focus. And we would be able to secure a more responsive and democratic system when it comes to, for example, planning and the approval process for new planning developments, because often we've seen countless examples where inappropriate developments might have been approved, even when they have adverse impacts for local communities and for nature. And it's important to say that this isn't just about NIMBYism and about people wanting to like have a blanket lock on every new development which happens. I think there's recognition that there's different considerations which need to be balanced in terms of net zero and like long-term changes across the whole country versus more immediate concerns. But it's also not a dichotomy, and often there are really valid, legitimate community concerns that planners or government at national level might not be attentive to and might disregard if they don't have a duty to take the right to a healthy environment into account. And there's a couple of very real examples of that, I think, where it could have made a difference, but where, as things stand, it's been a very flawed process in a planning system. So one example is St Vitus's Park in Torrey in Aberdeen, part of which has been rezoned for industrial development as part of a proposed energy transition zone. And so Simplex Park is the last green space in Torrey, which is one of the most deprived neighbourhoods in the whole of Aberdeen, and is really valued for local communities, for health, leisure and recreation. It also has an award-winning wetland, which is painstakingly restored by communities and has been kind of commended by CEPA, by Nature Scott. But all of this is now at risk and could be sacrificed as part of this rezoning process and this new development for this transition zone, which would kind of be ostensibly for the purposes of things like hydrogen and offshore winds. But it's being spearheaded by the former oil tycoon Ian Wood. And it's really, I think, a really vivid example of where there's been a really sustained campaign by local members of the community. There's very coherent arguments of why this is an inappropriate site for the transition zone, why there's other potential areas on that part of the coast which might be more appropriate. Yet those voices have essentially been disregarded. And despite the really clear breaches of their right to a healthy environment there when it comes to access to green space, when it comes to you know, having all sorts of other areas where this would impact their health and well-being, this development has been kind of steamrolled ahead, and there's a real risk to the kind of a breach of trust essentially between rights holders and duty bearers. But yeah, currently there's like legal elements missing, which mean that it's very hard to secure accountability, despite the way in which there was a kind of lack of democratic process there as well. So yeah, I think that's a really good example of where if planners and councils had a legal obligation to consider right to a healthy environment, these sorts of disastrous decisions could be avoided, and that we'd have a more sensitive, thoughtful and more functional process.
Yeah, no, that's really great and a really, really thorough example. Just going to move to our question and answer now. And our first question, Benji, is on the UNCRC. So do you see the UNCRC Incorporation Act as having teeth in relation to children's rights to a healthy environment, especially come the 16th of July, when we know that children's rights are currently not being realised in relation to their housing and school environments?
Yeah, great question. I think it is a major step forward, and I know it's been a long journey to get the UNCRC Incorporation Act. So I think, yeah, there's a really positive step forward there. But I do think it's going to be limited in terms of the impact it can have overall. And I think there's a risk, obviously, with the Scottish government, especially. We've seen a tendency for them to kind of point to certain things that they have done as an excuse for not taking action elsewhere. So for example, kind of like deflecting in terms of policy areas. So with the right to food, which is one of the parts of the substantive parts of the right to a healthy environment, there was a big public campaign to get that included within the Good Food Nation Act, and the Scottish government opted not to do that, saying that it would be included as part of the human rights bill. And I think, you know, there's a risk that there needs to be a more coherence in terms of like how different parts of legislation work with one another. And again, like having it in law is important, but then we also need to have those access to justice reforms so that it's possible to enforce these rights. And that goes to UNCRC as well in terms of access to justice and having effective remedies. So I think that's the most important thing, to be honest.
Brilliant. Just before, we've got one more question in the chat box. I'm just going to ask pre-submitted question actually, and it did come to one of your points about the relationship between environmental rights and other fundamental rights. So the right to a healthy environment is deeply intertwined with other human rights, as we know, can you discuss the relationship between environmental rights and other rights, such as the right to health, water, and food?
Yeah, sure. So I think, as I mentioned already, the right to food is a good example where it's something which we think is very important to have as part of the right to a healthy environment, because it relates to the other substantive features. So agriculture, obviously, we know there's impacts in terms of water pollution with effluents from livestock kind of polluting watercourses, and also air pollution from ammonia. But then there's obviously all of the health dimensions of our food system, which need to be taken into account. And then, of course, there's the fact that the right to food is due to be incorporated in the Human Rights Bill as part of ICESCA, the Convention on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which is also very significant and really foregrounds questions around access and distribution, which is somewhat distinct, but then nevertheless still related to the sustainability concerns of the food system. So I think obviously we need to have a much more holistic approach when it comes to policy making and think about these issues not in terms of like dichotomies or policy sides, but recognize how yeah, there's a certain need to recognize, you know, different priorities and how they're brought together in terms of policy. And I think it's also important that these different rights, are attentive to both social justice considerations in terms of universalism with access, in terms of services, in terms of responding to different needs of individuals who might have particular unmet needs. And then also think about these environmental dimensions and the impact it has in terms of air, water, land, and the quality of the broader environment which we all inhabit.
Brilliant, thank you. Another question from the chat here is, we know that various gypsy traveller sites are located either near or on top of polluted and toxic sites. In the Highlands, one community is located on top of a former landfill site. The council claims that the site was cleared and made safe for the site, but is that really ever possible? And what routes to justice can these communities take?
That's a really... Sorry.
I was going to say, I assume that means right now as well, in routes to justice that we already have.
Yeah, that's a really great question and a really good example of environmental injustice and a breach of, environmental rights, really. It really foregrounds how marginalized groups often bear the brunt of environmental pollution and how public authorities may often kind of consider the needs and rights of such groups as kind of secondary and an afterthought, may claim to have been taking action, but there's been a breach of trust and there's still concerns which may not be fully addressed in terms of the response of the public authorities. So I think in terms of this particular example, but it also applies to other cases where communities might not feel like their voice is being heard. There's obviously different routes to remedy. In terms of the political process and in terms of the legal process, so obviously the political process, there's the standard routes in terms of right to MSPs, councillors and so on and so forth. But I guess I would speak more to the legal side of things, partly because that's very much what the Environmental Rights Centre for Scotland is about. So one thing I would recommend is getting in touch with us. We have a free advice service which can provide support to individuals and communities in terms of the the best routes to remedy in these sorts of situations. And it's a bit like the Citizens Advice Bureau, but for environmental matters. So if people may be concerned about a particular issue, but don't really know the best course of action to address it, that's the sort of thing we can help with. And I would really urge anyone to get in touch with us if that's the case. In terms of this particular example, there's a couple of options. So there's a environmental watchdog we have in Scotland called Environmental Standards Scotland. And we've worked with a number of communities to submit representations to this watchdog based on complaints from members of the public. And it means that if there's particular areas of pollution or contamination or kind of failures in regulation and policy, we can write to them, and they have enforcement powers who can push the government to act. If they agree, once they've completed their investigation, that there's a problem which hasn't been sufficiently addressed. So recent cases that we followed up on have included the enforcement of licenses for water quality and breaches of licenses where there's been instances of pollution, and also around bathing water, and how bathing water designation occurs in Scotland to ensure that, again, there's regular monitoring, testing for water quality. So yeah, appealing to this environmental watchdog is one option, but there's also the option of legal action if there's consistent failure to engage and take action based on the concerns raised by community members. And we obviously would try to provide support in terms of legal routes to remedy, to hold the government to account in that case, or the council, if there are really unmet concerns around pollution and safety, which are failing members of that community. So yeah, that would be around, you know, accessing the funding to take forward a court case. So it might be legal aid if that was an option, or other sources. And in terms of having our solicitor be able to provide support, assembling the evidence needed to take forward a case. And also in the future, we're hoping to establish ourselves as the only environmental law centre within Scotland, so that we can take on cases directly to represent individuals and communities who are being adversely impacted by environmental harm. So I think there's going to be an opening to take forward more and more of these cases. But again, it really is impacted by the extortionate cost of going to court at the moment and these legal expenses. So the priority we have is to eliminate and reduce some of these legal expenses, so it will be much easier for communities to have a legal route to remedy.
Brilliant. Thanks, Benji. Just in my last couple of minutes, we don't have any more questions from the chat, but I'm just going to ask one more question and exploit my position as chair. Do you think that the right to a healthy environment, along with other human rights, is well understood by the public in Scotland? What steps could be taken to improve awareness, if not, and ensure better implementation of rights? And whose job would you say that is, as well, to better inform the public?
Yeah, that is a good question. So I think intuitively people do have an understanding that, you know, there's real issues in terms of how our environment has been treated and the implications that has in terms of our health and well-being. Obviously, we've seen massive protests in recent years around the climate, but also nature. And I think there's real vivid examples of communities rallying to, you know, save local woodlands or green spaces, where people do really have a clear understanding of their environmental rights, essentially, even though they might not frame it in that way. So they have that intuitive understanding. But I think the difficulty is, again, people not knowing how to exercise those rights, and not having kind of clarity of being able to understand some of these more systemic issues. And there's been like a real failure in terms of communication to really articulate that in the public sphere. So yeah, we know there's a huge unmet demand for environmental justice across Scotland, and we've had over 250 inquiries to our advice service the last couple of years since we've been going, which really highlights that there is broad public concern around the environment. And these queries have come not only from the central belt of Scotland, from Edinburgh and Glasgow, but from all areas of Scotland, including the most disadvantaged areas. So yeah, I think that's a really significant, but as I mentioned, it's about how to exercise those rights, which more work is needed to communicate that, and about the procedural elements that I mentioned earlier on. There's uncertainty about how to enforce the rights, who's responsible for which policy, and how people can get that route to remedy, which there currently hasn't really been public awareness outreach campaign to do that on a kind of mass level, national level. So I think that's really critical, and I think you know, there's responsibility for all of civil society to do that and work together, and have these conversations like we're having now to recognize how environmental and human rights are very much related. But obviously there's also a duty that I think needs to be there's a responsibility for both the media, for the government, and you know, all figures who kind of have a public profile to be better champions of the right to a healthy environment, and to yeah, really ensure that it remains part of like the national conversation, and that it's not just pushed to the sidelines, because it actually does have a fundamental importance for all of our lives in Scotland.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And what a good note to end on. Thank you again, Benji, and the Environmental Rights Centre for Scotland for joining us today. And thanks to all of you for taking some time out of your lunch to join us as well. Please visit our website at HRC Scotland to see our upcoming events. And we hope to see you at something soon. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Human Rights 2020s podcast. For more information about our work, as Scotland's civil society network for the protection and promotion of human rights, please visit our website at www.hrcscotland.org or follow us on Twitter at @HRCScotland. Thank you.